Coming up on Triangulation, I'm Jason Howell, and I'm sitting down with Ryan North. He is the author of How to Invent Everything, a book that will give you all the information you need to know if you get stuck while traveling in time. That interview is next on Triangulation.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Triangulation, episode 366, recorded on Friday, September 28th, 2018. Ryan North. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Grammarly, the communication tool that helps improve your writing for every occasion. Start writing more confidently for work, school, and even on the go. It's a great way to double-check your important papers, documents, and even avoid future typos. Get 20% off Grammarly Premium today at grammarly.com/triangulation. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a real game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Triangulation. This is the show where we get the chance to sit down with people who are writing cool things. Oftentimes, it's authors, but, you know, in kind of tangentially or directly related to the world of technology. And I'm super pumped for this episode because not too long ago, Carson put on my desk the book How to Invent Everything. And it really is everything. I mean, it's really intense, the detail and I don't know, the ground that is covered within here. And I should also mention, this is not just an invention guide. This is about how to invent everything in case you happen to be stranded back in time. If you're a time traveler and you get stuck somewhere other than your own time. So this could come in very handy and could save your life someday. Joining us is the author of this book, Ryan North. How are you doing, Ryan? It's great to get you here.
Thanks for having me. I'm doing well.
Absolutely. I should also mention, like, writing this book is not the only thing you are known for. You're known for quite a bit. Dinosaur Comics, Adventure Time comic, when that first kind of hit print, To Be or mm-hmm. Not to Be, that is The Adventure, which I've been playing on my phone, Marvel's Unbeatable Squirrel Girl comic series. You got a lot going on, man. You're a busy guy.
Yeah, you've grabbed stuff from the past couple of years, so it makes me sound like I've done this all just recently, which is great. I'm now the most productive person in the world.
I still feel like you're one of the most productive people in the world.
Thank you.
Well, it's great to get you here, and I've had so much fun reading your book because it's giving me so many ideas on things that I don't necessarily have to wait to time travel in order to do. It's kind of like a how-to guide on so many things we take for granted. But it's an amazing book, and the detail kind of floors me in all of these different aspects, all these different directions you go. Even though it's tongue-in-cheek, it still is incredibly informative.
Yeah, I wanted it to be like, it's a fun book and it's a funny book, but it's also, I want it to be a legitimate answer to the question of what do you need to know if you're stranded at any point in Earth's history to rebuild civilization from scratch? And that's kind of a big topic for a book. It took me a while to make sure it was even possible, because the whole idea is like, let's collapse civilization into 400 and some odd pages. And A, can we do that? And B, will it actually be useful to do that? Like, will there be enough that you can actually build a credible civilization out of this? And I was really happy to find out the answer was yes, because I was already several months, almost a year into the project at that point. It was great to have that confirmed.
At some point, I'm sure, like, when you're starting a project like this, you're asking yourself, well, it's a cool premise, but can I actually pull it off? But obviously, yeah, at some point, you realize you're this far into it, and you're like, actually, like, when you're talking about, like, the history of civilization, there's enough content there to pull from.
There is. I had the advantage that since the book is so focused on technology and ideas, I could skip some stuff that normally trips up regular history books, like people and places.
Yeah,
there's some of that in the book when people show up for doing important things, but there's a lot of just, here's the idea you need to know. Here's what you need to build this from scratch. We won't worry about who invented it in the first place, because you're going to invent it in the first place, because you're the most important person in history right now.
Yeah, you're definitely, if you're the time traveler with this book in your time travel vehicle, can't remember what the model number. You would know the model number, right?
The FC-3000.
Okay, yeah. Thank you. You're in the FC-3000. It breaks down. You're certainly armed with all the knowledge you need to be the most important person in the world. I guess at that point, it's just executing on all of those ideas, which you couldn't possibly execute on all of these things. So you really have to kind of take your pick.
I mean, I feel like the most important thing there is to build a dog out of wolves. With about 30 years of directed selective breeding, you can get a dog out of a wolf, and then you've made your best friend. Like, you're good to go. You're set.
Yeah, I should mention you have a dog named Noam Chomsky, which I love that as a dog
with
name.
With a P, yeah, because he's a dog.
Chomsky. So would you say that's kind of like one of your big takeaways? I mean, you're obviously a dog lover. That you could breed your dog. You could do that now, right? Like, you could make your own breed a dog now.
Yeah, I mean, that a lot of people have done it. Yeah. A lot of these dog breeds we have are just people saying, you know what? I want a dog that looks like this. And then they see what comes out.
Yep.
So, yeah, you can make your own dog breed today. You don't have to wait until you're stranded in history.
Well, let's kind of take a step backwards a little bit, because I really, like, I want to talk all about everything that's in here, although it's very challenging to talk about everything that's in there because you do cover so much ground. But I thought we'd start kind of backwards a little bit, talk about kind of what led to where you are right now, because you're very, I mean, I know that you said it makes you sound like you did all of these things and accomplished all of these things in a short amount of time. The truth is, you accomplished all these things. You're a very accomplished person, and it's really impressive to see the arc of how someone gets there. So, like, you've written a lot. Obviously, you have a love for writing. Where did that begin? Was that as a child? Were you a creative writer, really enthusiastic about comics? Where did that begin?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've always loved comics, but when I was a kid, you could only get comics in comic book stores, and there wasn't one in the small village I grew up in. So I was kind of just in love with the abstract idea of comics. I liked what I thought comics were, and I knew Superman and Batman from just general cultural osmosis from TV shows and stuff. But it wasn't until I got my first job out of high school that I had gas money for a car. And with my first paycheck, I walked into a comic book store and just randomly grabbed some comics off the shelves. And I was like, yes, I do like comics. This is working out well. But I only really started writing, I did creative writing in school and stuff, and I liked it. But I only really started writing in what I'd call a serious way when I launched my webcomic Dinosaur Comics in 2003. And that was sort of the start of where everything else came from, where I spent Dinosaur Comics, I should say, it's a webcomic. It's the same pictures. There it is. Same pictures with different words. So those same six panels of T-Rex and Dromaeosaurus and Neutraptor, I've been changing the words on them for the past 15 years. So
not with a minimal amount of updates either. You're doing this 2 to 3 times a week, right?
Yeah, it used to be 5 times a week, and it dropped down to 3 times when I started doing other stuff.
I keep waiting for the image to change. It's not flexible layout.
Yeah, it's not going to change. No. You're there for a while.
And I think I even found a video. I should have put it in the prep notes, so I apologize, Carson. But I found a video on YouTube that someone had of your notepad as you're scribbling out these ideas.
Oh, and yeah.
It's like a 30-second video of sped up, of course, but kind of shows your process. And I mean, of course, at this point, you have a mental idea of each particular block and where that goes on the image and about how many words fit into each of those blocks, because you're literally using the same layout every single day for years.
Yeah, I used to do them on this. I used to print out blanks and just draw them on those blanks. And now I know the layout, so I just drew in this text file. But the funny thing is that if you look at these scripts, I know who's in each panel, so I know who's speaking. So it's just dialogue for all these characters. And if you look at it in your text file, like if I leave the window open, I come back, I look like a crazy person.
Yeah.
Because it's just a script with someone arguing with themselves about like ethical relativism in plain text. It's like the weirdest thing you'd find on someone's screen that you just close and pretend you didn't see because they're clearly insane. I often think like Dinosaur Comics, it's the same pictures, different words. I've been doing that for 15 years. It seems like that's a fun project. That's a fun art project. But it only reads that way because I've been doing it online at one a day. But if I had not been publishing these, if I had just, you know, wallpapered my house with them, I'd be the craziest person. Or if you died and you found a stack of 3,000 comics all with the same pictures and different words, you'd think, like, what is wrong with this person? Oh, there's a video. I made this by simply writing a comic and then running the undo buffer all the way and then running it forward again.
Yep, that makes sense. Okay, so you're not even fast forwarding. I mean, I do this a million times because usually when I'm writing, you know, scripts for the shows that we do here, I've learned my lesson not to do that directly into Google Docs because you just never know what's going to happen. So, I mean, that's exactly what I do. The notepad becomes my eternal kind of memory and you can undo as much as you like.
You can see me sort of trying to figure out what the punchline is there and rewriting the comic till I find. But the thing with writing comedy, this is my secret to writing comedy, and it's embarrassing because all I'm trying to do is make myself laugh. And so I can't do that publicly. I can't go to a coffee shop and write because you look like the biggest loser sitting at the heap going like, good, funny.
I'm so good.
I did an interview once with my old campus paper at Carleton where I started Dinosaur Comics in 2003. And it was a student journalist, and I said, like, where do you get your ideas? And I said, oh, I have these this text file of unfinished comics that are things that, you know, snippets of dialogue or ideas I'd like to explore. It's just stuff so if I get stuck, I can look at that and find an idea. And they said, oh, interesting. Thank you. And then when the article was published, instead of text file, it said I have a giant textile, like a rug that's full of ideas that I look at for inspiration. It's such a better origin story for where this stuff comes from that I will say I have a rug and that is where I get Dinosaur Comics from.
So you said that that sounds stupid, but you write to make yourself laugh. And I would argue that anyone can write to make themselves laugh, but there's also a level, a sense of humor that others have to connect with. And obviously you have that, right? Like if you're making yourself laugh and you're publishing it and your comics are as successful as they are, then you have a sense of humor of the type that other people can connect with. So that's, I would say, equally important. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think part of that's luck too. I remember in a similar interview, I said I'm just writing for anyone who shares my sense of humor.
Right.
And that made print as anyone who has a sense of humor, which is way more egotistical.
Right.
But it's that plus like you start to realize how jokes work and what works and what doesn't and the sort of the ideas behind jokes. And it's hard because there's no real laws of comedy. You're always trying to surprise, you're always trying to be creative, so it's very hard to set rules around that.
Yeah.
But you can still almost instinctually start figuring out what works or what doesn't, or what you'll get emails saying, I do not understand what the punchline is here, and what with a way to rephrase that to make it more accessible so that you can lead people to where they want to go rather than losing them.
Sure. I think what impresses me most, like I've always thought it would be really cool to be able to write something and to continually write on a daily basis. But there's that fear that you're going to run out of ideas. And I'm sure that's a pretty common fear for anyone who writes for a living, I have to imagine. Yet you're doing this. I mean, and we're only still talking about Dinosaur Comics. You're doing so many other things. But you're doing this with fresh new content on, you know, in some cases, a daily basis. Have you ever kind of hit that point where the well is empty and you're just like, I got to put something there, so, you know, make it the simplest comic ever. I don't know what you do with
that. That's where the rug comes in.
Yeah, okay. All right.
But very early on, I was worried about that. I was thinking, you know, doing a daily comic, you're going to run out of ideas, especially a comic where it's the same six pictures. Like, that is, there's a limit here.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine said, you know, if the thing is that you're not worried about running out of ideas, the thing should be, you once you've had ideas, once you've written something for, say, a month, and you know that even on days where you can't think of something, you will get there eventually. You realize the problem isn't having ideas, it's choosing which idea to do. And I found that a very comforting thing to think that I'll always have ideas, I'll just need to choose which is the good one to run with. And that sort of helped me, that gave me the confidence to think I won't run out of ideas. I'll just have to think harder until I come up with one.
Yeah, and when you're producing that much content, it's less about being perfect or being, you know, being a perfectionist. It's more about like understanding what the level is to, like, some of them are going to be amazing and some of them, you know, you're going to hit the end and you're going to be like, hey, well, you know, this wasn't my best one out of the 5,000 or 6,000 that I've done already, but I'm willing to call it and like move on and expect that 2 days from now I'll do a better one. Sure. Whatever, post.
Yeah. The rule I live by is that I should always feel good about something when I'm putting it up. I don't want to put up something that I think is bad because it's probably bad. But if I feel good about it when I'm writing it, when I put it up, then at least I have that little defense. And I've put up stuff that probably was not very good, but at the time I thought it was great. And hopefully someone else thinks it's great. The funny thing is, when Dinosaur Wars Comics was starting up and getting a larger audience, I reached this point where I started to get statistical certainty if I said something. I did a comic about someone getting their bike stolen, and I had 3 emails saying, oh my God, my bike was stolen today. And I was like, huh.
Oh.
I guess at a certain size audience, things just happen.
Yeah.
And so it became a thing where I could mention something and it would be like I was speaking to that one person. And so that one comic became their favorite comic.
Right.
Because almost if I turn the camera so that, you know, I see you there, Jonathan. And all the Jonathans be like, oh my God, he's speaking to me. This is amazing. But that is a cheat because you know I'm doing it on purpose. But yeah. When you see in a comic, it speaks to you. And that's what I love about webcomics is that since you have this large audience, you can reach a huge audience. You can do stuff that couldn't be sustained in a newspaper or even in a regular publication because it's too weird. It's not popular enough. But it'll be popular for the people who find it and like it. And then it feels new and fresh and special and like it's written just for them.
Yeah.
And I love that you can reach someone and it'll feel like this is the comic that was written for me.
Sure.
I think that's the greatest thing of the internet right there.
Yeah, right on. Well, that speaks to so many different kind of creative outlets, let's say, or you know, creative endeavors online, is that so much, I mean, even here, podcasting, you know, we do podcasts, but so much of it is viewer facing to the point to where they can connect with us directly. Like that's the internet in a nutshell. The people that you follow, that you're passionate about, you know, following their work or whatever, they're totally accessible and they're totally connectable in a certain way. It becomes
sure.
more of a personal thing. Before we move on from Dinosaur Comics, I have to ask you one question. I know that I've read that you're not an artist. You're an author, not an artist. Are the dinosaurs clip art or are you a clip art artist?
I would like to tell you that I've been doing that comic for so long that now I just, you know, write the binary in by hand to quickly whip off what the picture should be. But the truth is, they're clip art, but they're posable clip art. So you can move the dinosaurs' arms and legs and stuff.
Oh, okay.
But, I say that, but most of those are the default poses.
That makes it better, though, in my book. Yeah.
I mean, so one of the rules of comics is that your character shouldn't stand on the panel boundaries. T-Rex is clearly standing on the panel boundary. Utahraptor's tail in the fourth panel there runs up with the boundary. Like, oh, there's so many mistakes, not the least of which is dinosaurs shouldn't be standing like that and should have feathers. And a T-Rex was not a 7-story tall animal. But
yeah, there's
I
the
worked with what I knew at the time. Yeah, this is a snapshot of what I knew of dinosaurs in 2003.
And
now, whenever there's dinosaur news, people email it to me. So I'm very up to date on the cool dinosaur facts.
Yeah,
but at the time, I was not.
I wonder if that house and that car are to scale. I'm not sure entirely.
They're not. Nothing
I think you did
comic.
A good enough job.
I have emailed paleontologists when they email me, and I'm like, I'm so sorry. There's so much wrong.
Yeah,
like, no, we love it. It's fine.
Yeah, because you know they know all about your comic, so they're following.
Yeah.
I think they've forgiven. So flash forward then. Well, you know what? Actually, I'm realizing what time it is. We need to take a break real quick. I'm going to throw this break, and then we're going to get into your time with, a pretty recognizable...
And Jake.
Adventure Time. I have a coffee and an Adventure Time mug to honor you, sir. And we'll talk about this in a second. But first, let's thank the sponsor of this episode, and that is Grammarly. When you're writing, it's important for you to write well. This is something that I have to teach myself time and time again. And if you don't already know, Grammarly is actually a perfect tool for that. It's a communication tool that can help improve your writing for all sorts of different occasions. And it's awesome. It kind of runs in the background on your machine. It's a cross-platform, and it just kind of sits there and waits for you to type. And as you type, instead of just being a spell checker, it's a grammar checker. And it does a really great job. It's a great way to double check your important papers, documents, even avoid future typos. They have a free version that you can use to get started. You can check it out and get it integrated into your workflow. It's available, like I said, across platforms. So you can get it online, desktop, and even on your mobile devices, iOS and Android. And it's just really easy to install and have it working when that's done. Grammarly's premium version allows users to personalize their experience settings to write for different occasions. So maybe you have one setting for school, one for work, one for when you're doing creative writing. And you can have Grammarly remember new words as well as you go along. And in addition to spelling and grammar, Grammarly Premium helps with advanced punctuation, structure, style within context, vocabulary suggestions, conciseness, and readability for different occasions. And 85% of surveyed premium users identified themselves as stronger writers, and 76% now find writing more enjoyable. And what I've found is the more you use Grammarly, the more it opens your eyes to grammar mistakes that you make repeatedly. And so sure, it helps you correct those, but then over time, you correct yourself, right? Like it's an education as well on how to write better so that Grammarly doesn't have to help you out each and every time. Go to grammarly.com/triangulation and you'll get 20% off Grammarly Premium today. That's grammarly.com/triangulation, and we thank Grammarly for their support. And now it's time to talk about Adventure Time. All right, so Ryan, 2012 happens, comes along, you know, it's just another year, but it was kind of your move into mainstream comics. You got somewhere along the way, you got worked into doing the Adventure Time comic. The series was already on TV, so yours was the initial kind of print comic. Is that right?
Yeah, it was. I wish I had a better origin story for this, because it was the first print comic I ever did, and it was my gateway to everything else. And people are like, "Oh, how did you get to write Adventure Time? That's amazing." And the answer is, my editor Shannon Waters emailed me and said, "Would you like to write Adventure Time?" And I said, "Yes." But the more interesting version of that is that the reason she emailed me is she had been reading dinosaur comics since she was in university, since she was, you know, growing up. And I had thought for a decade I was doing my fun talking dinosaur comics. What I didn't realize was when you're doing something online like that, it's not just the art you're creating. It's also showing, it's like this really weird long form visual resume where you're saying, like, I can meet a deadline, especially a self-imposed deadline. Here's the type of jokes I like. Here's what I'm interested in. And so when they needed a writer for Adventure Time, I'm like, oh, Dinosaur Comics is not that far from Adventure Time. Let's see if the Dinosaur Comics guy is available. Mm-hmm. And I said yes, because I was a fan of the original YouTube short and I loved the show. And I wouldn't have said yes if I hadn't been able to watch everything there was that was Adventure Time. Because I used to read Star Trek novels when I was a kid. And when they got the canon wrong, I'd be like, this isn't real. You know, that's not what Data's processing speed has been established at. This is incorrect. And I didn't want to be the guy writing incorrect comics, but since Adventure Time at the time was so much smaller, I could know all there is to know about Adventure Time.
Yeah.
And then write comics that would fit into the canon, that would be canon in the same way.
How much Adventure Time do you spend analyzing Adventure Time before authoring Adventure Time? Like, what went into it, like leading up to kind of getting ready for the comic and everything?
Yeah, the nice thing was I chatted with Penn Ward, the showrunner at the time, and the guy who invented Adventure Time, and he gave me some secrets of what was coming up in the show, which was nice, so nice. I could sort of lay some seeds for that in the comic. And really all he did was he's like, yeah, I read your pitch, I like it. Instead of using this new bad guy invented, why don't you use the witch? And I was like, I can use the witch? And he was like, yeah, use the witch. He's a big bad of the show. Go for it. Make the comic as crazy and big as you want. And I was like, wow, okay. Let's do that. Great. I was assuming that I wouldn't be able to do big things. It was just, you know, the licensed comic.
Yeah.
And he literally gave me permission to go big and do whatever I wanted with it. And I feel like it worked out. We got some Eisner Awards for the comic, mm-hmm. which is the mm-hmm. biggest award in comics. So that was terrific. And it was a really fun experience.
So it's almost like the comic itself existed on a similar but different timeline than the actual TV series Adventure Time.
Yeah, we tried to make it fit as much as possible. But and with anything like this, they start to, you get inconsistencies. They're like, okay, well, there's a comic universe and there's a TV universe, and they match up a heck of a lot, but sometimes things don't quite line up in the same way. And I made it so that my hope was if you watch the show, you would read the book and be right at home. What I wasn't expecting was I'd meet people at conventions who said, you know, I started reading the comic book and I didn't know they made a show out of your comic book. The show's really good too. No, it doesn't go that way. I'm thrilled you think that's the way it went. Like, thank you, but that's not how it went.
Yeah. How did you first discover Adventure Time? That formulates your view on that. Now, this was your, like you said, this was your first print comic, first monthly comic. So I imagine with that comes a certain level of pressure. Anytime you take something creative and you apply a timeline on it, it makes it a little more challenging. I mean, did you feel pressure in that regard, or was that pretty natural for you to manage?
A little bit, but I've been doing Dicer Comics for a decade at that point, and so I'm used to meeting a daily deadline, and this was a month deadline, which felt really spacious.
Yeah, that's true.
And so for the first comics, I would leave lots of time in case I needed it, but I realized I can usually write, if on a good day, I can write about 7 pages of print comics if things are going really well. And so I can budget, you know, it'll probably take me 3.5 days to write the bad version of the comic and another couple days to fix it and punch up the jokes and make it so I'm proud of it. So about a week for 20 pages is what I've learned I can manage and not freak out about. Mm-hmm. But there's always issues where they go slower and you think, oh, I needed 2 weeks. Good thing I gave myself 2 weeks. I always try to start like at the start of the month so I don't miss deadlines. Because the thing with print comics, I think the casual people don't really realize until you start writing them, is that when you're the writer, A, you have the easiest job because it takes 10 seconds to write on this page. Finn fights a bunch of monsters, a million monsters. They'll take all day to draw. It took me 1 second to write just now. So writers have the easy job, 100%. But B, if you don't get your stuff in on time, nothing else can happen. Like the editors can't edit, the inkers can't ink, the drawers can't draw, the letters can't letter. Like you are the single point of failure in this. And so I think part of the job of the writer is A, to write, but also B, meet the deadline and be there on time, because you can ruin it for everyone else.
Get it out of your hands so you know your duty, your job is done here. I imagine, well, it seems like you have a passion with, or at least a fascination with choose your own adventure stuff, because Adventure Time Series 10 or Adventure Time number 10 was a choose your own adventure style
comic book.
Choose Your Own Adventure Time. Sorry, my apologies. Yes, exactly. And then in 2013, you had a novel that you released, Choose Your Own Adventure book, based on Shakespeare's Hamlet, called To Be or Not to Be. That is the adventure. I'm assuming as a kid, like I was as a kid, you were into these Choose Your Own Adventure books. But how challenging is this to actually write?
Oh, they are. They're hard. I'll say that they're very hard.
They have to be. Yeah.
I actually started trying to write one earlier and I couldn't get anywhere, because the problem is you start a story and then what happens next? Anything can happen next, and you need to pick the most interesting of those many things. It felt very hard. But then when I decided, what if I did Hamlet? What if I made Shakespeare into Choose Your Own Path, Choosable Path Adventure? It became easier because the story had this spine in it. You know what's supposed to happen, so you can branch out from that. You get the characters for free. You get the setting for free. You can go wherever. So the books are thick. They're like 700 nodes, 450 pages. They're huge, huge stories. And I used software to keep track of where the story was branching, where the nodes came back in together. It becomes very complicated. And I was trying to figure out, like, how did the Choose Your Adventures that I read when I was a kid, how did these books get written? Because it seems impossible to keep track of all this stuff. Like, you'd have to have, I call it an insanity wall, the thing in movies where there's just papers on the wall with strings between them.
Yep.
And anyway, a friend of mine was friends with an author from that time period. He was like, oh, no, that's how we wrote them. Like, it was, there's a reason those books are thin. It's because we had these insanity walls. So in a sense, I like two things. One, I like that in a sense, this book couldn't have been written until more recently. And the other thing I like to say is that, you know, I've written a lot of stuff, collaborated with my buddy Shakespeare in a couple projects. No big deal. Me and Bill.
You can put that on your Wikipedia page. And of course, you know, it's on your Wikipedia page, of course. You also turned this into an app. It's actually what I've been playing around with, kind of moved it into an iOS and Android app. How involved with that integration were you? Or I imagine at that point, the direction of the story was already made, so probably pretty easy to hand that off to someone to do.
Yeah, we did the recording of the audiobook as part of a Kickstarter stretch goal we did, because we launched a book on Kickstarter way back when. And so I was there while we were doing the audiobook version of it, which was fun. I kept apologizing because there's stuff, you write stuff and it sounds good in your head, and then when someone reads it out loud, it's not as good as you thought, or it's hard to say.
Right.
And you tweak some stuff. We did the audiobook before the book came out, so I could change some stuff in the book to make it better once I heard it out loud.
Oh, okay.
It was funny because I hired the reader, Matt Yantha. He's a great guy. I'm like, yeah, it's a nonlinear book, but you'll get it. There's nothing else beyond prose. You'll do a couple voices, it'll be fine. And the first day, he hits the node that is a rap battle where he has to rap. And I was like, I'm so sorry. I forgot there was a rap in this. There's a couple other parts we have to sing. Surprise. Thanks for doing this project with me. But for the actual app, it was once we had the audio down, it was they sent me different builds they had, and I would give feedback on, you know, this doesn't work or this could be more intuitive. Yeah. And the end result was really cool. Like it fits very nicely in that space of an iOS or Android game where you can play it. It'll read it to you. It's portable. It feels like there's not a lot of games like it, and it's weird to think of a book as a game, but choosable nonlinear books are games, and so it's a very natural marriage in a way that surprised me.
Yeah, they absolutely are games. I loved those as a kid, and I also loved, you know, text-based games like Zork and that sort of stuff, so it kind of falls into a similar category, not quite the same, but I think it's a perfect fit for app. Of course, there's Marvel's Unbeatable Squirrel Girl. You're doing the comic series there. The series debuted in January of 2015. I guess at this point you were already award winning, as they say, critically acclaimed comic author. How did this kind of appear on your desk?
This happened because my editor there, Will Moss, had read some of the Adventure Time comics, and that gave him a feel for kind of stuff I like doing. And I got an email from him saying, hey, you know, hypothetically, if there were a Squirrel Girl comic, what would it look like? What would you do with that? And my first response was, Squirrel Girl? Isn't she the one who talks to squirrels? Like, what is this? And so I read Squirrel Girl's Wikipedia page, my first stop for research. And then I read all the Squirrel Girl comics that existed at that point, which wasn't that many, so I could read them all again. And I started thinking about the character, and by the end of the weekend, I knew that I really wanted there to be a Squirrel Girl comic. I really wanted to be the one writing it. And so I sent in this pitch, and the sneaky thing about the pitch, I said, let's do this fun, you know, it'll be an all-ages book. You don't need to know tons of Marvel history to read it. It'll be really accessible, and it'll be about Squirrel Girl. It's going to be terrific. And the secret there was I pitched it as not needing all this in-depth Marvel history knowledge, because I didn't have that in-depth Marvel history knowledge. Like, this was all new to me. Mm-hmm. So I managed to get around it that way, and I know a lot more about it now, and I feel much more at home in the Marvel universe. But at the time, I was like, I know Spider-Man, and I know all the villains from the movies, and I love Galactus, and that was where I was starting at. Which is why Galactus is in the first arc, because I think Galactus is great. And a great foil for Squirrel Girl, and they're friends now. They work it out.
Yeah, and you're doing this, you've been doing this now for 3 years. You actually made Squirrel Girl a computer science student working in STEM, and I know you have a computer science, is it a master's degree? Yeah, master's degree in computer science and computational linguistics. I guess talk about your driving force. Like you probably could have gone in any direction with the foundation for Squirrel Girl. I'm imagining you had a lot of creative leeway there. Like why did you choose the way you did?
Yeah, you're right. They Will said, you know, she can do anything with her. She hasn't been seen for a while, so she could be anywhere you want. Just do whatever you want. And I thought of making her a computer science student, because when I was an undergrad, I was in a lecture hall with like 400 people, and there were two women there. And that was crazy. Like, there's nothing in computer science that should exclude women except for the people making it exclusive. So I wanted to show, like, yeah, here's a woman in STEM, and she's really good at it. And she's – it also – the selfish reason was that I knew I could write that. Like, I really wanted there to be computer science in this book that was legitimate computer science and not comic book computer science. So Squirrel Girl is in kind of this fun place where – she lives in a comic book universe. She talks to squirrels. She has proportional speed and strength of a squirrel. She leaps like a squirrel. But when she needs to hack into a computer, like, she is legitimately dealing with buffer overflows and SQL injection and stuff like that. So the computer science is real, even if the squirrel powers aren't quite as legitimate. And it was fun to sort of have carte blanche to do something like this, to take a character and say, well, what's the best version of this? What fun can you have with it? And it's really a rare pleasure, I think. Normally when you write a comic, you're dealing with everything that's come before, and you just can't throw it out. But Squirrel Girl had so little stuff before, and what was there was already really good that I could just build on it and run with it.
Yeah, right on. And then I know that I think it's this week, Marvel Rising with Squirrel Girl on Disney,
yeah, it's coming
right?
out on Sunday.
That comes out on Sunday. Are you excited about that? What, were you involved in the production of that in any way?
A little bit. I didn't write the script, but they sent me the script, and I was like, this is a good script. Run with it. And I wrote a YouTube short that isn't out yet that's about Squirrel Girl and Tippy Toe fighting a monster with the help of Doctor Strange.
All right, on.
Who is thinking, what are you doing here? I am a legitimate doctor, and you are a student talking to squirrels, fighting this alien with me. What is happening?
Right on. So that happens this Sunday. So everybody should look out for that. Let's take a quick break. We haven't even really dove into I would say, the main reason that you are here, which is the fact that you wrote this awesome book. So we're going to talk about How to Invent Everything after a quick break. We'll thank the sponsor of this episode of Triangulation. That is Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. If you're searching for a house, maybe you're looking to refinance your home, you've undoubtedly been tuned into kind of what's going on with the Fed and the interest rates, and they're kind of creeping up. So that can make people anxious, can make people nervous. A lot of anxiety comes, you know, when you're searching for a home. Do I need to buy right now because things are going to dart up? Well, that's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage, because it makes that a lot easier. They've actually created a new process here called the power buying process, and it protects you in this kind of environment that we're in right now. Here's how it works. Step one, you answer a few simple questions, and they're going to check your credit for pre-qualified approval. That gets you pre-qualified as you need to be. Step two, Quicken Loans will verify your income, your assets, and credit in less than 24 hours to give you a verified approval. And that actually gives you the strength of a cash buyer. You're verified, approved, and you can start going and hunting for your home. Once you're verified, you qualify for their all-new exclusive Rate Shield approval. And this is kind of the kicker right here. They're going to lock your rate in its place, whatever the rate happens to be on that day, for up to 90 days while you shop. So, that locks it. It's not going to move anywhere. If rates happen to go up, your rate is going to stay the same within those 90 days. But if rates go down, your rate also drops. So you win either direction. If things go up, you're not up with the market. You're below the market. If things go down, you're with the market because you want to be there because your rate is even better. Either way, you win. It's the kind of thinking that you'd expect from America's largest mortgage lender. So to get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Rate Shield approval is only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. That's rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support. All right, now it's time to talk about time travel. All right, so this is the part of the interview where we kind of dive into what it's like to invent all of these crazy things that we take for granted. I feel like that, what I walked away from the book with is that we do take so many things for granted, right? Like, this book covers so much ground, and I'm very curious to know how you researched for it, or if this is just kind of information that you have, you know, bouncing around inside the brain of yours. And if so, man, I want that brain. But it's so comprehensive, yet at the same time, so many of these concepts that it took humankind, you know, our entire existence to figure out, seems so simple when you look at it through the lens of the book. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So the book started because I saw Back to the Future when I was a kid, like a lot of us did.
Yep.
And then I spent the next 10 years thinking about time travel, which I think a lot of us did. And I think if you really sincerely interrogate yourself about time travel, thinking, what would I do when I go back in time? Not if, but when. What would I do? You realize that you're probably going to be pretty useless outside of a very narrow range. Like, I can go back and warn my previous self about, I don't even know, lottery numbers or something, but send me back 100, 200 years and you're kind of reduced to saying, you know, in the future, it's great. We have computers. And people say, cool, how do you invent computers? And you say, I don't know. But when you have them, they're going to be terrific. Like, that was my sincere worry of being a sucky time traveler, being trapped in the past and not being able to answer questions. And I kept wanting for there to be a book that told you what to do when you were a time traveler. And eventually I wrote it because I didn't want to write. It was a lot of work to write, but I wanted to read it. And so you got to bite the bullet and produce that stuff sometimes near writer. So the process of researching it was basically a lot of work, a lot of reading, a lot of everything. But I remember the fun part was making a list of stuff that I thought I might need before I'd done any research and saying, I think this might be important. And then going through that and trying to figure out what the missing pieces is, what's the connective tissue that I need. Like if you're going to invent a computer, you need to have all these other inventions before that, the prerequisites. So I started building a tech tree for real life technology, which was a lot of fun, and just started assembling it together. And like I said, it took me a long time to realize it would even work. I thought I might just have a bunch of weird essays on different pieces of technology until it started to coalesce into, okay, no, this will work. You can build a time traveler guide to civilization. This is actually a possible project, which is always nice. Like, I feel like whenever you are in the middle, in the weeds of a big project, you think, oh no, I've done it again. I've chosen to do something impossible. And it's only experience that teaches you that it's usually not impossible. It's just really, really hard. And you can work with really, really hard. You can't work with impossible. If something's hard, there's a way through there. It's just difficult. Right.
Yeah, there's some sort of path to be found. The challenge is finding that path. Filled, obviously, with technologies, maybe we can kind of dive into kind of the overarching fundamentals that you list. There's five of them. There's spoken language, written language, non-sucky numbers, air quotes on non-sucky, scientific method, and calorie surplus. And like I could imagine from a research perspective, like, I don't know if you start there and then you span out or if you have everything out and then you realize, hey, they fit into these five neat categories. But that really does seem to kind of cover the basis of the foundation for what needs to be there for so much in this book to even exist, right?
Yeah, and you're right. I did the other stuff first and then came back to that to be like, what are the critical things here? But the neat thing about all those technologies is that they're all information-based. Like, once you have the idea of them, you're good to go. And I feel like it strikes a lot of people as weird to think of language as a technology because we didn't know, none of us remember having to learn it. You get it for free almost, even though you didn't get it for free. You had to learn it as a child. And the crazy thing about babies is they not only learn a language just from hearing it, but also have to invent the very idea of language. Like they have to hear people speaking and think, I bet you that contains meaning. I wonder if there's a grammar. Maybe these are nouns. And like you're doing that from first principle. So learning language is incredible. But you need someone there in the first place to be speaking it. And that's a big leap. But you get that for free as a time traveler. You already have language. You already have writing. You just need to teach it. And calorie surplus is basically, okay, so you start producing more food than you need to eat. So you don't have to worry about where your next meal is coming from. And once you've got that squared away, when you're not worrying about where your food's coming from, you can start worrying about other things like, why does the sun seem to rise and set? What is gravity? Let's puzzle this out. And non-sucky numbers is just to avoid the faults that we had dealing with what I call in the book sucky numbers, where, you know, Roman numerals and stuff like that, where it literally holds back your civilization because you're trying to, it's very hard to do math if you have a number system that doesn't support, that gets in your way and prevents you from thinking clearly about numbers.
Yeah.
So save some time. Skip Roman numerals.
No one wants the Roman numerals anyways.
They're no good.
No, I
the scientific method, of course.
Yes. Sorry. I'm sorry. Go for it.
The scientific method lets you produce knowledge in a way that is repeatable and testable. And doesn't give you perfect knowledge, but it lets you produce knowledge that's gradually more correct. So you'll make mistakes, but you'll be able to test those mistakes and learn that they're wrong, which, again, we didn't have for a really long time, and it led us to things like, you know, thinking diseases are caused by an imbalance of yellow and black bile in your body, which is not the case. But we thought that longer than we've known what a germ is. And there's been more progress that's been made in medicine since we came up with science and invented the germ theory of disease than there has been in all the centuries before that, because we were laboring under bad ideas that we couldn't test because we didn't have science.
Yeah, at one point, I have kind of like a list of a few things that while I was reading, I was like, I don't know, for whatever reason, it made me smile or kind of scratch my head or go, man, that's so much more simpler, you know, more simple than I thought it was. But right. The penicillin part really struck me, where you had a civilization pro tip. Sometimes all you need to do to become one of the greatest scientists in history is to pick your nose and wipe it on a petri dish. Because from there you end up you end up kind of getting to penicillin very easily. Weird little things like that, and I think you point this out time and time again throughout the book, that all of these things are foundational, but at some point someone decided to mix this with that, or to I think what was it, tie a rock to a string
for the compass. Yeah, it's crazy. It really underlines, like, so many popular science books take the premise, which I think is pretty fair usually, that humans are pretty smart, look how smart we are, here's the cool things we've done. And the fact is, when you look at when we had what we needed to invent something, we had the prerequisites, when we actually invented it, there's usually gaps of thousands or tens of thousands of years sometimes, because it takes innovation and bright ideas to come up with this new stuff. The compass, the one you mentioned, is great because 200 BCE, we have the ancient Greeks noticing that some rocks stick together. They've discovered basic magnets. And we only met the compass in 1000 CE, and there it's used for fortune telling. It takes another 100 years before it's used for navigation. And so there's 1200 years where we could have invented the compass and didn't. And pardon me, like you say, it's just that inventing a compass isn't, you know, the tiny piece of metal balanced on a pin wrapped in plastic. It's just tying a rock to a string, because the string lets the rock rotate freely. The rock points towards magnetic north. That's your compass. All you need to do to invent a compass is tie a rock to a string. It took us over 1,000 years.
To think about doing that.
There's room to improve.
Obviously, there's room to improve. But then at the same time, like, it's easy to say that in hindsight, right? Mm-hmm. On so many things, hindsight is 20/20. Easy to think that we should have discovered this sooner. But even the simplest things are difficult to spot when you're in the moment, right? Like that seems like the easiest thing, and the most, you know, it's surprising that no one ever did that before, tied a rock to a string, but they didn't, because there was no reason to, until some point they thought maybe this would be a good idea. Like, why does it take so long to figure these things out? I don't know.
I think that's kind of the stealth, most inspirational thing in the book. I never said explicitly in How to Invent Everything, but there's this idea, sort of hopefully implied, that if there are all these instances in history in which we had what we needed to invent something and didn't invent it until a long time later, it stands to reason by analogy that there's probably something right now in 2018 that we could be inventing but haven't invented yet, that we have everything we need but haven't put the pieces together in the right way. And I think that's a really fun, really inspirational idea to know that there's something new out there that anyone can invent. You just need to figure out how to do it, where to put the piece together that we already have in the right way. And I'm definitely not going to be the one to do it, but I can't wait to see who does actually invent things like that.
Or maybe you will, because a lot of times, like, I think a lot of times invention happens when people least expect it or aren't trying. You know what I mean? It's just suddenly you have that light bulb moment of, well, but maybe I should tie a string around the rock and see what happens. It's not something that you set out to do. Today, I'm going to tie a string to a rock for no good reason. Like, it hits you for a certain reason, and that could really happen to anybody. But yeah, that's kind of what I felt about this. The book is really about invention as a whole and how we discover these things. And you know, like I said, how we take for granted all of these things, because I can't tell you how many times I've seen something and I'm like, man, okay, so someone created that, someone designed that, and that is the easiest thing in the world, yet they are rich because they thought of it first. Like, what is the thing that I haven't thought, that no one's thought of, that is the easiest thing in the world and I haven't discovered it yet?
When I was a kid, my babysitter, she'd always say that her husband could have been rich because he invented dental floss when he was a kid, where he just took a thread and used it to clean between his teeth, and that was before flossing was a thing. And I guess that stayed with me, the idea that something that simple, something that, you know, we're all, I don't say we all do, but we're all supposed to do it, is so modern, right? Like, it's a modern thing. There's all this stuff that we take for granted that is surprisingly recent. I mean, the stethoscope is a great example of that, where they were invented in 1816 CE. And when that happened, it was a male doctor, a presumably heterosexual male doctor, with a busty female patient. And he wanted to listen to her heart, and he thought, this is too erotic an experience. I better roll up a tube of paper and listen through that to leave some room for Jesus here. And doing that, accidentally discovered, hey, this tube of paper isolates and magnifies the sound I'm trying to listen to. And that's the stethoscope. Like, that's the first stethoscope. It works. And all you need to do that was to roll up a tube of paper. We had paper in 300 BCE. Like, it was waiting for us this whole time. And it's actually one of the few instances I could find in history where legitimate scientific progress was made by someone being too horny to do their job properly.
All right, we're all laughing in here. Moving on. Let's say, I'm going to ask you some hypotheticals. Let's say you zip through time, your machine breaks down, and you're stuck. You want to pick something that you can create that is the smallest amount of effort, but the biggest bang for your buck, biggest bang for your time. Like, you know that you want to do, like, I guess when I was putting this together, I was thinking, like, often when I sit down with a project, like, you either approach it from get the difficult stuff out of the way first or get the easy stuff out of the way first because you can accomplish more. If you want to get the easy stuff and accomplish more, what are a couple of things that come to your mind that would be a good direction to go?
So, easiest thing in the world, especially if you're between 2000 BCE and 5000 BCE, this is a time period where at 200,000 BCE is where we have something called anatomically modern humans, which are people who look like us, and 50,000 BCE is where we have behaviorally modern humans who behave like us. They create art, they bury their dead, that sort of stuff. There's this 150,000 year gap, and we don't know what happened to change us from anatomically modern to behaviorally modern, or why it took so long. One of the theories is that we finally invented language. And once you start speaking to each other, you develop culture. You have ideas that can escape your body and live in someone else's body. You start realizing that other people are just like you, only in a different body, that sort of stuff. And so if you want to have the greatest influence on history, on humanity, for the least amount of work, travel back to around 200,000 BCE, find some of these anatomically modern humans, take one of their babies, or don't steal the baby, just talk to the baby. Teach those babies language, because humans learn language much easier before puberty than afterwards. So teach these cave babies any language you know. We'll start with English because we're speaking it right now. And you'll be giving every single civilization on the planet a 150,000 year head start. Like, that is phenomenal. And all you need to do is chat up some kids until they learn to talk back to you. It's the easiest thing in the world. It's the most fundamental course you could have in history. And you might end up, you know, if we were 150,000 years more advanced right now, maybe we will have destroyed the Earth. You always roll the dice with time travel, but maybe not. Maybe we'd all have jetpacks. Mm-hmm. You know, there's one way to find out.
That's awesome. By the way, I just also want to mention one thing that struck me about the direction that you took your book is, and you say this in the very beginning, that your vision of time travel is not that if you go back in time and you make a change, then it messes everything up in your timeline if you return to present time. But rather, you're actually creating a new timeline that branches off. If you are to return, you'd still return to your normal timeline. So the things that you do in the past aren't necessarily going to affect your current timeline. I feel like so much science fiction related to time travel is the Back to the Future approach. And I feel like you kind of took it in a different direction.
Yeah, I did it for a couple of reasons. One is I wanted the premise to be this was a rental time machine from the future. And so if you have one timeline that gets changed, that's a wildly irresponsible thing to be doing, to rent out time machines to members of the general public willy-nilly. So this solved that problem, but it also introduces kind of like dark humor aspect to it, because if every trip back in time creates a parallel universe that's exactly like ours, except you're in it, you're creating, you know, millions, billions of human lives for the purposes of tourism or entertainment. That's also wildly unethical, or the very least fraught. And so it gave sort of this fun, dark humor to the whole thing. But also I think there's a lot of fun story potential there. To doing time travel without worrying about messing up the present lets you worry about all sorts of other possibly more interesting things.
Absolutely. Do you believe that we'll ever actually achieve time travel, actual time travel in maybe not even in our lifetime? I think that's a huge bet, but do you think it's possible?
There's this great quote from Stephen Hawking before he died saying that the greatest proof that time travel isn't possible is that we're not being visited by tourists from the future. And I read that as a kid and I was like, this is devastating because I want time travel to be real. I'm totally devastated. But I comforted myself by thinking, you know what? If you got the widest range of history, what makes this time period the most interesting? Like, maybe they're not coming here. Maybe we're boring.
That's
the problem
true.
Is that, like, the past 2018 has been very interesting in terms of stuff happening. And I haven't noticed any time travelers yet. So they might just be good at blending in.
Yeah.
But I feel like time travel exists. You'd probably have people checking up and like, what was it like, you know, on September 28th, 2018?
Maybe in the future, if time travel is some sort of thing that someone can pay to, you know, it's a tourist sort of thing, they probably have like an onboarding session that you have to go through on how to really blend in.
What the slang is.
Yeah, exactly. You probably have to get educated. And maybe that's just uploading some information to your brain so that, you know, you're perfectly convincing.
Yeah. Gives you the window of when you can say lit sound.
and when you should stop. If given the opportunity to be the first person to travel through time, would you do that? Would you jump at that opportunity?
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I would. No second thoughts. I mean, I was going to say ask my wife, but I'd bring her with me. I feel like, like, why would you not do it?
Yeah.
It's such an appealing idea. Even if there's a chance to die, I'd be right there. I don't want to die, but dying for the chance to go through time, like that's worth it.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah,
I agree. I feel like a lot of people would agree with me.
Yeah, I think so. I think the possibility of dying would probably stop some people, but it just really depends on the people that you care about and who you leave behind. I suppose that's the greater risk. But
you get to be the first person as a tombstone. This is like Ryan North, born 1980, died in 1655.
Yes. Died somewhere in time. Who would you meet if you could choose to meet one person while traveling around through time?
Oh gosh, that's a good question. I don't know. I need like an hour to figure this out or more.
All right. I know. I'm throwing a few things on you.
I should have an answer for that though. That's something I should be like right off the top of my head.
You got it for your next interview. There you go. what did this book teach you about the lives that we're living now and the era in which we live right now?
The thing I really took away from this was that we live in an era of specialization where we go to school, we learn something, and the more you learn, the more you get specialized, the more you learn more about a smaller subject, which is great because that's how you push the world forward. When you know more about something than anyone else in the world, you can discover new things about it much easier. And we have enough people that we can have someone specialize in a very minor subject. I did my master's in light verb construction, which is a tiny, tiny element of language. And that was the only thing I studied for my master's. But because of that, we don't have a lot of general knowledge. We don't, like, I didn't know how to make soap. I couldn't walk into any room in the world and generate electricity out of a couple magnets. But writing the book and reading the book and learning from the research, it made me feel like a more competent time traveler, which also made me feel like a more competent person. Just knowing how things work around you makes you feel like, yeah, I think I'm doing adulthood right here. Like, I feel good about myself in just general baseline competency, which is a nice thing to have.
Absolutely. I think you're doing okay, Ryan.
I get by.
Doing all right. And I also have to say, so I have a 5 and an 8-year-old daughter. And in reading this, on one hand, it was reading a book about all these crazy things that have been invented and yes, time travel and all that stuff. On the other hand, it seemed like a really cool workbook for like a really boring Saturday to be like, okay, why don't we like whip together this magnet out of a rock and string?
Awesome.
You know what I mean? Like there's actual tangible stuff that you can go into here and be like, this complex concept can be broken down to this really simple activity, and it's a great teaching moment. So aside from everything else, it's also good for that, I think.
That's great. I should use that in the pitch. That's great.
Do it.
I love it.
Seriously, because I'm going to take it home, and I want to find a couple of specific things and kind of work through those with my kids, because
I think it
would be a lot of fun.
Such a good idea.
Yeah. Look, Ryan North, it's been awesome getting the chance to talk to you. Really appreciate you taking time out of your Friday to chat about your book. The book is called How to Invent Everything, A Survival Guide for the Stranded Time Traveler. And it's just a lot of fun to read. You guys are going to have so much fun learning so much about all of these things in the world that we take for granted. It's all based on inventions. It's all based on a whole lot of time and effort from a lot of different versions of us human beings throughout the course of time. And it's just really, really eye-opening and fascinating. And I just really appreciate your time today, Ryan. Thank you so much.
It was great to be here. Cheers.
Absolutely. And best of luck with everything going forward. And maybe with the next book, we'll bring you back and talk to you about that too.
How to invent everything else.
Yes, exactly. Thanks again, Ryan. We do this show every Friday starting at 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific, 2200 UTC at twit.tv/live. You can tune in live by going there and watch it as we record. If you're going to miss the live show, most people miss the live show, you can catch it in the podcast feed. And all that information is found at twit.tv/TRI or twit.tv/triangulation. There you're going to get the podcast subscription links. All of our episodes right now, we have a total of 365 other episodes beyond the one that you just watched. So tons of interviews for you to catch up on and enjoy, and we hope that you do. I'm Jason Howell. I love doing the show. Thanks again to Karsten. Thanks to Alex for helping out here in the studio, and thanks to you for watching. We'll see you next week on Triangulation. Bye, everybody.